Cisco 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living.
And I'm Martin Matthews, a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist with Healthful Living.
And as you can probably guess, you're listening to Healthful Living's radio show, Reality Sandwich, where every week we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the health of the mind, body, and our planet. So today we have a really exciting guest. His name is Michael Berman, and he is the author of a book called Living Large, A Big Man's Idea on Weight, Success, and Acceptance. And, you know, this is a little bit different of a topic than we usually have on the show, but I actually think, on the surface it appears different, but I think when we really get into it, it's going to be very relevant and very important to our listeners who are striving to be as healthy as possible.
Well, I think so too, Julie. You know, I first picked up this book and I didn't really know what to make of it because, you know, you and I were always talking about health and well-being, the mind, the body, the planet, and all these different topics and providing so much information. And it's so far broader. I mean, the whole notion of our existence encompasses all these factors regarding our interpersonal influence of one another and by one another, social contexts, all these different factors, some within our control, many outside of our control, that influence what shows up for us in our lives,
mm-hmm.
in all aspects of our lives, and with what's going on with our body and success in all aspects of life. So I'm looking forward to learning more about Michael's story, his lessons, what he's learned, and what we can share, and the amazing insights we can share with our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's see if we can get him on the line here. Mike, are you there?
I surely am, Julie.
Great.
Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. And do you like to go by Mike or Michael?
Your choice.
Okay. Very good. So it's great to have you on today, and I'm really intrigued. As I think you know, we are... I'm a nutrition consultant, and my husband, Martin, is a hypnotherapist, and so we are all about healthful living and doing your best to always kind of strive towards that next level of health or healing or whatever is necessary for you. And so I think that today's show is going to really add a lot to the listeners out there that are still sort of struggling to figure some of those things out.
Yeah, I sure hope so.
So firstly, tell us, why did you write Living Large?
Well, in the late 90s, I was about to engage in one more effort to lose a ton of weight, and I decided to start reading to see whether or not somebody else had some new thing that I hadn't tried that made some logical sense and didn't appear to be unhealthy. And as I was reading and reading and reading, something struck me, and that was that all the books by and about fat people were about by and about women.
Mm.
And I could not find a book in which a fat man was sharing his experiences. So I decided to see whether I could write such a book, and 7 years later, this is what came out.
And that's one of the things I think that's most interesting. Well, there's a couple things that I really find interesting. One is the honesty in which you approach the subject and also your perspective as a man. Maybe we can just talk about that. What are the differences? I'm sure it's not necessarily easier to be one or the other, but what are, for you, the differences between being a man who's overweight or a woman?
Well, I think society is much tougher on women than it is on men. I think it's much tougher socially. The example I use is, how many times do you see a really fat woman with an average size man as opposed to the number of sizes you see the really fat man with an average size woman? At least my experience is the latter is not common, but you regularly see it. The former you almost never see. So that's part number one. Part number two, there's numerous articles that suggest that in the area of employment, there's much greater discrimination against fat women than against fat men. If you look at the examples that we see in advertising, the female body is glamorized much more than men, although recent work suggests that young boys are now starting to experience the same thing that young girls are in terms of some of the images that are being cast there. And finally, just the simple thing of clothes. You know, I'm sitting here in a pair of gray slacks and a blue blazer. It is exactly the same costume I first got when I was 18 years old. And except the size is considerably different. But men's clothes simply don't change that often. Women's clothes seem to change all the time. So kind of being in style is much more difficult. And I also think, and this is truly anecdotal, that the manufacturers of men's clothes in general have gone big faster than the manufacturers of women's clothes.
Mm.
That is to say, I can go into a place like, well, in San Francisco, probably Rochester Big and Tall, which is down near the convention center, and I can find just about every elite man's label that you can find a store for. So if it's Burberry or you name it, they're in there. They have started either producing the clothes themselves or allowed to be produced with similar materials and similar styles. They're clothing in up to sizes 50 and 55 and 60. You simply, at least I don't believe that's happening with women, the manufacturer of women's clothes. There are some places, some specialty stores, but they're not carrying full lines
right.
of every dress designer.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that. That's fascinating. And that's another question is, I guess, well, maybe I'll save it for later, but a question that comes to my mind, and maybe it'll be rhetorical for now, is that good that we are, on one hand, of course, it's good that we can accommodate people, because why should people of different sizes, you know, not have the same...
options.
Thank you, as others. But then, is it, you talk in your book about our culture, which sort of promotes... overeating and things. So is this promoting it? I don't really think that it is. I think that it's just a nice way to allow options for everybody, which I think is important. But, you know, a little question in my mind is, you know, are we now getting more complacent, and is it more acceptable? And, you know, I don't know if it's good to be acceptable in terms of someone being a worthwhile human being, but I don't know if it's good if we sort of start accepting the unhealthiness that the average person might start to become. Does that make sense?
Yes. And my answer is we shouldn't become accepting of unhealthy things, and I would never suggest that. But what I do believe is that being fat is like a lot of other diseases. You may not have choices and options. I mean, I did 9 years of therapy in order to reach a point where I can keep off about 90 pounds from my top weight. But it is still a struggle every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I have found, particularly during talking to people about this book on the air, etc., I'm having the hardest time controlling my eating. Because one of the reasons I ate was under stress. So when I was really stressed, and say, if you were to look at my website, where I have quite a substantial list of the weights I've weighed at different times, you will find a correlation to major political campaigns in which I was involved in weight losses of 30, 40, 50, and up to 60 pounds.
Mm.
And these were very stress-filled environments, 7 days a week, 7 in the morning till 10 at night, around the clock, get some sleep and come back, and sit at your desk. Most of my jobs tended to be relatively sedentary. And a high degree of, especially at the presidential level, high degrees of tension all the time. And the way I kind of kept myself cool was to stoke the furnace with whether it be ice cream or pizza or whatever else I desired at the given time.
Sure. And, you know, what we know now from a biochemical level is that stress releases cortisol, and cortisol actually is a fat-storing hormone. And so there's not only the response that when we become stressed, food becomes comfort, but when we become stressed, there's actually a physiological and a biochemical response that causes people to gain weight. So there are definitely components in here. And before I actually continue, I got so excited to launch in, I forgot to kind of give a little bit of a background on who you are and what you do. So maybe you can tell the audience, you have a very kind of exciting career here.
66 years old. I live in Washington, D.C. I'm trained as a lawyer, although I haven't practiced law for a long time. I'm a lobbyist. That's how I make my living, basically with the federal government. Although I'm not a government employee at this time, although I've been at various stages in my life, I've been employed by the government. And I'm very involved in politics, and operational sides of politics. And I do a fair amount of nonprofit advocacy work as well.
Yeah, not a low-stress career, I can see already.
No, and usually balancing more than one thing at the same time, so...
Right, right. Well, you talk about fat as being a disease, and I would love to explore this a little further. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you just look at the definition of the word disease, in just pick up your dictionary, it describes chronic diseases as something that can't be cured, that is serious, active, prolonged, deep-rooted condition, and where the primary goal is to manage it. Well, to me, that describes at least my fatness to a T. And so my management of fatness, I don't find it. I happen to have kidney disease, which is either accelerated with or created by my fatness. I manage that within a particular series of ways. And I think you really have to manage fatness in exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to read a piece from your book here, and then I want to, it's going to, I believe, bring around that concept of the disease again, because I want to talk about it a little bit further.
Sure.
It says, along the way, I've realized something, that my best chance for peace of mind and also for controlling my weight lay in accepting my situation. I don't mean giving up hope of being thinner. I have always tried to lose more weight and always will. I mean being honest and realistic about what I'm up against. I've accepted the hard but liberating notion that I have a disease. My fatness is not a function of willpower or discipline or laziness or weakness. It's the result of a physical and psychological factors that are outside of my control. Like diabetes or flat feet, my fatness is a chronic malady that can't be cured but can be managed.
Right.
So that's in your introduction, and, you know, so I was pretty much hooked from the beginning. And I really believe, I definitely agree with many things that you're saying here, that I do think that it's really important for us to accept who we are, because if we don't do that, then very frequently that brings up feelings of not being worthy or not being lovable or whatever these things are, and then it becomes very difficult to go through the challenging journey of getting to where you want to go if you can't sort of love yourself where you are today. We all know that I'll love myself when I'm thin doesn't really work, because we can't really get there until we love ourselves to begin with. So I definitely agree with that, and I also agree with the willpower thing. There are so many factors that are outside of our control. There are, like we talked about, biochemical responses. There's chemical cravings that happen due to nutrient deficiencies, due to food sensitivities or allergies, due to stress and cortisol production, low thyroid. All these things are actually physical factors that are involved. The little challenge I have is it says the result of factors that are outside of my control, and they can't be cured but can be managed. That's the little part I'm still sort of, I would love to kind of dig into a little deeper, and I think Martin has something that he wants to say here.
Well, I just wanted to throw in, you were talking about, Julie, the things that can't be controlled. What else came up for me are factors that happened before we ever arrived, right, in our genetics and our parents. And really, as children, so many things for the first many, many years of our lives, we do not have direct control, many of us, typical, you know, growing up here in America, over so many of our influences, how our parents treat us, our family, cultural issues, all these different factors that influence the behaviors that we get instilled in us at a very young age, and those patterns that initiate themselves very, very young. So we don't really have control
mm-hmm.
over all those things. And when
right.
we're growing up, we can't always say, hey, wait a minute, I don't want this environment around me.
Right.
You know, hey, grandma, stop hocking me with the whatever. We don't always have that.
But here's my case. Fair amount of work, I've been able to determine the size of every direct relative going back to my great-grandparents' generation.
Mm.
And there is not a single person who you would even come close to describing as fat other than me. If you'd met my parents before they passed away a couple years ago, or you met my two sisters, as Carol says, facially we look a lot alike. The rest of it, we could be from two different planets. They're both slim, both lovely, smart, accomplished women, but nonetheless, there is no fatness in my family. But on the part of the growing up piece, I think you've really hit something that's very important. Through the years of therapy I went through, one of the things I came around to understand was my mother tended to be a relatively controlling person. And she would control me, not in any what you would call ordinary abusive way, but she was afraid of everything. So I wasn't allowed to learn how to swim. I had to be home usually more earlier than anybody else, even as a youngster. I had to always be within earshot kind of stuff. There's a whole variety of ways, based on her needs, whatever, that caused me to feel in control. But the one thing she could not control was my ingestion of food.
Mm.
Because, as I think a report in the book, at a very early age, I started getting up in the middle of the night, going into the kitchen, and selectively taking food from different, you know, packages. Later in life, much later, when I was in college but still living at home, my mother would create these. She was a great baker, and she would bake all these various delicacies, and then she would put them in the freezer. And I would very carefully go through and remove X number from each package. They were in plastic containers, and thaw them out and have them. In addition to whatever I was eating when I sat down to a meal at home, let alone once I was really free to move about. By the time I was in junior high school, one could easily find, you know, get food in a variety of places. As a youngster, I think I reported in the book that I stole small amounts of money from my dad and from my mom, from their purse or their pocket, to buy candy. Some of it to kind of deal with some of the bullies that I was encountering because I was fat, but others just for my own pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was my way of kind of exerting control over something that effectively she could not control.
Mm. I think that's a really important point, because I think there's, boy, in life it's just inevitable. We're going to come across traumatic situations or experiences that shape us, and I think that really understanding how those experiences in childhood affect us can really be helpful in helping us move forward and change our reaction to certain things in the past.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. And quite frankly, it was in therapy that I finally got to the point, first of all, that many of the feelings I had, I could realize that, in fact, I wasn't crazy, that mm-hmm. I was having a lot of feelings that a lot of other fat people were having, and that was a big day. But then becoming to understand that there were some reasons why food, because that's what, you know, obviously drives my fatness. I mean, I'm not discounting any other factors that may be there, but it is the consumption of food. When I would sit down, for example, and even as an adult, and eat 2 pounds of chocolate almond bark, you can do the calorie counts probably better than I can. We're talking about, you know, something in the neighborhood of, 4,500 to 5,000 calories
mm-hmm.
in a setting.
Wow.
And because it felt good, because I liked it. I mean, I often referred to food as Valium,
mm-hmm.
without the need for a prescription.
Right, and it really is, actually. Sugar and different carbohydrates can increase serotonin levels in the brain and
right.
do all sorts of things. So when you talk about a food addiction, and from that perspective, I would absolutely agree. This is not just a matter of willpower. This is serious biochemical responses that are creating these cravings that are actually become addictions. I guess the place where I am is I always try to say, okay, well, now we've got this disease, if you want to call it that, and how can we get to the underlying bottom of it, and how can we remove it so we don't have to manage it and deal with it all the time, but we can try to do our best to move past it, or, you know, as opposed to carrying the burden along forever and ever. So that's just a little, I guess, subtle difference in the view of it.
Well, no, I mean, that's the underlying dilemma. You know, what I call the recidivism rate of people that lose large amounts of weight is huge. And Mark Haman, in his new book, Ultra Metabolism, says that his view is based on some research that he'd found, that he didn't do it himself, was that about 2 to 6% of people that lose large amounts of weight actually keep it off.
Hmm.
And I've seen a number of other studies that have it in about the 85% range gain it back. And certainly my experience up to the last time was always to gain it back, and usually with a little bonus.
Mm-hmm.
Until I worked my way up by 1984 till I was 332 pounds. I mean, I never weighed that much again, but I got as high as 317 pounds on more than one time since then.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really, I don't think we have the techniques yet that the medications that are out there, quite frankly, they've got a ways to go yet, but frankly, I find them probably more desirable as maintenance devices rather than weight loss devices, because the amount of weight you actually lose with those medications is relatively small. It may well be just the edge you need in a maintenance program.
Mm-hmm.
I've said many times and continue to say that losing weight is the easiest part of the deal.
Right.
It is the day that you feel comfortable about yourself that the weight loss has really slowed down to almost zip. And you start to get comfortable again, and you start to slip. And in my case, to show you how really screwed up I am, I weigh myself every single day. Now, I know there's all kinds of theories, should you weigh yourself or not. I weigh myself every day. And so I've watched myself gain 100 pounds day by day and been unable to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Since I finished my therapy, at least this time I've stopped it, seemed to be stopped at around the 240 range, and I can pretty much hold that. I actually developed a little technique when I was at, I worked my way back up to 250, and I said, I'm going to defend 250. And so as soon as I popped over 250, I went to the GW Weight Loss Center and would go on a protein sparing fast for a couple of weeks and take off 15 pounds, and now I've moved that number down to 240. And maybe sometime in the fall I'll try to get on to 230, but that's probably the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty comfortable. I've had one knee replaced. At the end of the year, I'll have the other knee replaced. So athletically, I'm back in shape. I do a lot of exercise. I've just taken up yoga, which I happen to think is a – I wish I'd done it years ago because I think it's – with a good instructor, yoga is a marvelous exercise for fat people.
Great.
Because it's so malleable. I mean, you can – with the right instructor, you can – I don't know how much you know about yoga, but
mm-hmm.
there's this position called downward facing dog.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for the first 13 months, I've done downward facing dog against the wall in the studio. And a month ago, I did it for the first time on the mat, on the floor. Now, it wasn't pretty, but I did it. And I've done it every week subsequently. Malleable is the word. You can create, the postures can be used for almost any size and take into account all of this physical, there's various postures, for example, that are affected by the fact that I still have a very big belly.
Mm-hmm.
And that belly gets in the way of any number of postures and poses.
Right.
And so we modify them. At any rate, I guess there's enough about yoga, but I'm pretty much into health and fitness, quite frankly, as being the two critical pieces of managing this fatness disease, if you will, because on the health side, there are things you can do. I have high blood pressure. I have high cholesterol. I have kidney disease. I have osteoarthritis. I can do things about all those separate from losing weight. It would be nice to lose weight. It would help each one of them. But the fact is, if I don't, I can manage them. And so the finding of the appropriate doctor is a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And if I go to a doctor and his first prescription for me is to lose weight, it's the last time he and I will have FaceTime.
Right.
Because I know when I come in the door at 300 pounds, I know that losing weight would be helpful. I'm there for a different kind of help. The second thing I've already mentioned, which is the whole fitness. About 80 to 85% of people that end up in nursing homes in America, turns out, end up there not because of disease, but because they can't do basic functions like getting off a commode,
mm-hmm.
putting on their clothes. And so I've changed the word fitness to functionality, which I use in the book, because that's an important piece. And again, with whether it's yoga or other kinds of exercise, you can improve your musculature. You can improve your ability to do things in daily life. And for me, it's an actually really big deal, the fact that I can now bend down at the waist and tie my shoes,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to sitting down on a chair and putting one leg over the other in order to tie my shoes. It's a combination of two things. It's a combination of, I've done enough work, enough stretching, so I could actually bend down and touch my toes. And so there's a lot of things you can do. And then at the end of the day, the real message, I think, of the book is, look, we all have things we do well. And we got to focus on those kinds of things. And that's what's really at least worked for me, which is to say, gee, I'm good at being, whether it's a politician or I'm good at being a lobbyist or good as a photographer, whatever it is, and really enjoy those things and kind of not worry so much about what the rest of the world thinks. Now, at the end of the day, when I'm really feeling good, if you want to lose some weight, you can go to the epilogue of the book, and I've got some rules. No diets, but some rules.
Oh, yes, it's great, in fact. I'd love to talk about you talk about our culture and how our culture really, you told some great stories about the ice cream shop and things,
right.
And how our culture really celebrates or strangely supports this huge portions overeating. Do you have any sense of why that is? Or
I really don't know. I think the portion size has a lot to do with trying to create value in a competitive environment.
Mm.
That, you know, if you take the simple hamburger. I don't know if you're old enough, but, you know, a hamburger was a hamburger. It was, you know, it was probably about 3 ounces, maybe 4 ounces in the hamburger. That was a regular size hamburger. Now, if you look from one chain to another, you can find hamburgers that have 3/4 pound of beef in them.
Yeah.
And 2 or 3 ounces of cheese. And each one has grown up as if the way to compete with, you know, the hamburger stand down the block is to create a product that was roughly the same, maybe a little bit more expensive. You know, it's like the movie theater when you go in and they say, you get the small popcorn, and they say, gee, for a quarter more, you can have the large one that's almost twice as big.
Right.
And it really doesn't cost them very much money, but the number of calories you consume
mm-hmm.
is more. But they're doing it as a commercial thing. They,
sure.
They can actually, it's economical for them to sell the bigger, more economical for them to sell the bigger bag than it is the smaller bag.
Mm-hmm.
And the public ends up with a lower quality product.
Oh, absolutely.
More mm-hmm. of it.
Yep.
I wanted to ask you, did you have another question?
No, go ahead.
I'm definitely grabbing a theme here of acceptance. Acceptance of, you know, where one is, and that that's beautiful and wonderful as it is. You know, focusing on what do we do well and understanding, you know, what it is that we want to move towards. I hear in your story both the notions of focusing on losing weight, that component of what's going on with your overall health. And then I hear you talk about health and fitness as well, which is this other side of the spectrum of saying, okay, I've got to also be focusing on my well-being and moving towards something.
Absolutely.
So it's both of these factors. And a lot of folks get themselves so mired and stuck in this lose weight, got to lose weight, I have to do. And that prevents them from doing so because they... You know, where do they have any control? And I'm hearkening back now to your story with your mother as a child and coming right back to this part that's in the introduction where you speak about responsibility versus guilt.
Right.
And you say there that now that I don't have to lose weight, I can. I'd like you to speak a little bit about responsibility versus guilt.
Well, guilt's with you all the time if you're fat. I mean... I remember when I used to come home from law school, to come back to Duluth, I went to law school in Minneapolis, and I would arrive at the front door, and my mother would grab me by the cheeks, give me a big kiss, and then she would say, oh, you're so fat, and then sent me down to the dinner table, which was, you know, looked like a feast for 12, as opposed to the four of us. So there's all kinds of things that guilt drives you to. I mean, your size, with the way you... people are looking at you, the way people you think people are looking at you, which is sometimes worse than what they're actually doing. We read. I know I do it myself. I read things all the time. I just would feel guilty a lot. And I got, through therapy, quite frankly, I got over that and just decided that I had to focus on myself, that I was responsible for me. Nobody else is responsible for me. I mean, my wife is to be some extent, but nonetheless, you get my point. And that if we decide we're responsible for our own actions and deal with those things we can deal with and accept who we are, you know, I've accepted the fact that I'm a fat man. There's many other things that I am as well, but one of the things that I am is a fat man. So even at, you know, I'm sitting here, I have a size 50-inch waist, and I still wear a size 54 coat because of the size of my belly. That's just the way it is. And so that's... I have a responsibility for that. It's nobody else's fault. I mean, I spoke about some things that happened in my childhood, but I don't sit here and blame my mother for it. It's just something that happened to me. So I'm responsible for myself, and if I take responsibility for myself and do the things for myself that I can do that are available to me, I just believe I'm going to have a happier life, and it's certainly been my case.
Yeah, I think that's such valuable advice to hear. In our last couple minutes, what is some advice? I mean, I think you're one of the best people to help people out there that are struggling, that know what you've gone through. And one of the things I love about the book is how you really go into intimate detail of some of the pain that you had to go through. And I think that's really helpful for other people. Like you said earlier, I found out, I realized that I wasn't crazy or what.
Right.
Being that you've been through so many experiences, what advice do you have for other people that are fat?
I guess the first thing, and I don't really say this in the book, is see if you can find somebody to talk to. I had the opportunity and the capacity to be in therapy for 9 years. That's not available to the average person, and sure as heck, there are not enough therapists either. So, but to find somebody to talk to, men in particular don't talk. I have really interesting conversations, what I call intimate conversations, with fat women. I have never been able to engage a fat man to, in a conversation about his feelings about being fat.
Mm.
Women do it all the time. So find some place to get some release for whatever your feelings are, whether they're guilt or whatever it might be. See if you can't find, through counseling, through groups or something, some place to get some release for those feelings. And then the other things I say to fat people is the things I just said, which is, you know, see to your health. The reality is a really fat person is going to die early. That's just the way it is. And if that's the case, then let's make those years that we do have as good as they can be. And again, it's paying attention to your health. The second thing is this whole fitness and functionality thing. I didn't start exercising until I was 52 years old. Other than a few walks when I went to Pritikin back in 84, I didn't get serious about exercise until I was 52, which is like, you know, 14 years ago. That made a huge difference. And most of my exercise started with, was, I went to the gym a little bit, but I walked. And aside from the fact that walking, you see so much more than you do when you drive. I mean, I've walked by places that I've driven by 2,000 times. And I see things that I never saw before just by walking, but because it's slower. And you've got time to observe what's around you. So the exercise is like, and then the other part is just don't let other people get you down. Don't let their feelings about you or moments of discrimination or bias, whatever it is, get to you. Just decide for yourself that's their problem,
mm-hmm.
and that you're not going to let it be your problem.
I think that's the important part we were talking about at the beginning, where acceptance comes in, because only we can, you know, ultimately know how we feel about ourselves and what action we're going to take each day towards where we want to go, how
Absolutely.
We want to be.
So,
great.
Just kind of as a wrap-up question, what does the future hold for you, Mike?
Well, I do a lot of advocacy work, both in gun control and in gay civil rights. I still lobby. I work in Democratic politics. I'm an amateur photographer. I always look for something that you can do by yourself. I find that very restful. And I kind of let the future take care of itself now. I was in a job interviewing for an organization on which I'm on the board. We were interviewing people today, and I suddenly realized that I'd never had to face a group of people in a job interview, that every job I've ever gotten came in a situation where it was one-on-one, and it kind of came to me, just because of where I was at a given time or what I had done or what they were looking for. So, you know, I'm going to be 67 on Sunday. I've got at least another good 10 years, and something's going to happen.
Wonderful. Well, happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thanks to both of you for letting me talk about my book and what life has been like.
Absolutely. And give your website and your information so people can get a hold of you.
Well, the book is Living Large, A Big Man's Ideas on Weight, Success, and Acceptance, and it's MikeLivingLarge.com.
Great. Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you
for being on. We appreciate your honesty and your forthrightness in putting this out there and sharing some key insights with our listeners.
And thank you for giving me the opportunity to do that.
Absolutely.
Take care.
All right,
bye.
Well, how was that?
Fascinating.
I
appreciate his honesty. I appreciate him writing a book and just sharing his experience, because he's millions of people. Millions of people, I'm sure, with similar components of their story, of their history, of being able to relate to things that he's experienced
mm-hmm.
and has dealt with in his life, similar childhood experiences, I'm sure, to some regard, experiences of being, you know, picked at the whole guilt thing.
Mm.
Guilt is just, we could talk about guilt for months, about the impact of it and where it comes from.
Absolutely. Before we continue, because I would love to spend a little time talking about weight and being overweight and managing weight and losing weight and all of those things. But right now, for people that are just tuning in, I wanted to let you know that you're listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You are listening to Julie and Martin Matthews with Reality Sandwich. And we were just talking to Mike Berman, who wrote Living Large, and we were talking about everything that goes along with that. So I want to talk more about that, because I find it really really valuable to other people that are out there. And that's what I mentioned to him a couple times. What I really like about the book is he really, in semi-painful detail, describes what it was like for him growing up, what his, boy, what the struggles he had to overcome and all of those types of things. And I think it's really therapeutic for other people. I know that it has been in my life to know that you're not the only person going through an experience. Because once you can get past, like, oh, I'm not alone, I'm not the only one, there's not something wrong with me, then you can start to seek out some sort of solution.
Right.
And you can start to ask questions and look for help and ask for guidance. Because sometimes when we are, especially if you're a man, like he was describing, and you aren't comfortable talking about this, you're certainly not going to seek out help, and so your situation isn't going to improve in that case. So I really, for anybody out there that's struggling with weight, especially men that are struggling with weight, I think the book is really a really honest look into not giving up and keep trying to find something that's going to work, and at the same time accepting where you are so you can move forward, not accepting where you are so that you can stay in denial and stay this way forever and not have to try, but so that you can move past it and just keep, see it more as, instead of holding our breath waiting for everything to be okay, it's kind of like, okay, this is where I am, and now let me enjoy as much as I can of every day while I'm trying to figure it out, which
right.
is really what we're all, the journey we're all on, but just with different challenges.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the point we were making here kind of towards the end of our discussion with him, is that he has reached this place, it sounds like, where he's, you know, kind of now more in neutral zone, right, rather than it being always this problem that he had, this thing that was wrong about him, this guilt and shame all of his life that he was large, that he has learned now to bring in that, you know, what is he moving towards focus, that notion of what does he want, and that reaching that place of acceptance for himself of who he is and how he is an absolute requisite before he can start moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Because until we can discuss it, whether we talk about it as acceptance or loving oneself, I mean, there's many different ways to describe this notion of just being okay, right, with who we are, where we are, the fact that we exist in this moment in the condition that we comprise in our physical bodies, that we can at that point then say, okay, well, what do I want to be creating here? And when he's been so in the influence of all these factors that keep him, you know, keep us, or really anyone, you know, it's totally focused on and feeling guilty, feeling stressed, feeling shamed about the situation, going lose, I must, those are not the conditions that most empower our personal choice in taking proactive action, because then we're always, you know, reactive towards these things outside of us that are telling us what to do.
Right. And it sounds like what he's found, which is sort of similar to what you're describing, is just doing our best on a daily basis to try to live healthfully, whatever that means, versus being perfect or nothing, which is, I think,
right.
a lot of the trap that people get stuck in. Oh, if I ate such and such today, the whole day is blown, I'll just start again tomorrow, and then you just, one day after another goes by, and because you, the ideal that you're having to live up to is so difficult that it's never a good day to start today. And, you know, Oprah talks about this a lot, or I don't know if she talks about it a lot, but it seems to me that her approach is one that's really based on what's just, boy, I don't even know how to describe it, what she's living for every day, which is just kind of, boy. I'm lost for words.
Living day to day, being in the moment, going with what's real. I'm just throwing words in your mouth here, you know, this notion about, you were saying about being perfect or nothing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So many. I think if we distilled it down, probably all, right, of these fad diets, quick books, or going to, you know, some 1 week, you know, weight loss thing, I don't want to take anything away from the impact that those things can have for people, but
mm-hmm.
they are still in this notion of be perfect, you know, or nothing. It's like, fix this problem now, right?
Right.
And because we're so, those solutions are based on removing a negative, right? I've got a problem, let me get rid of it, let me lose, and I must, it's not so much, oriented towards moving towards and creating that acceptance within oneself so that we are proactively choosing to gain health as opposed to focusing on losing weight.
Right. And actually, that's one of the things he mentions in the book, is the faster you lose weight, usually the faster you're going to gain it right back. So he's learned over time that anything that's a kind of a fast weight loss thing is actually typically not beneficial for him in the long run, and he usually tries to steer away from those. But and it makes sense, too, if you, like you said, losing weight isn't the problem. Especially, he talks in the book about food addiction. You can't just, you can not drink alcohol, but you can't just not eat. So you always have the struggle of, okay, well, I have to eat, so how do I do that and not get carried away on a particular day? And so when he's talking about how do I lose weight healthfully and how do I do this in a balanced way, when you're not doing that and you lose weight rapidly, you often bring up a whole bunch of imbalances, often nutrient deficiency because you're not getting enough food, and so you're having these extreme cravings. You start flushing fat out of the cells, which starts flushing toxins out of the cells, and you can then get sort of toxin overload, and that can be not only physically uncomfortable, but not good for you in the long run. And so, of course, the stress of your body changing so quickly, the body's not really sure how to adapt, and you know, the body thinks it's starving and all these things. So that whole need to do it rapidly, as we've described in a variety of ways, just doesn't work. And so really searching out the method that's going to work for you is the secret. And that, of course, if everybody knew what the, if there were one answer to that, there'd be one person that would be very rich right now. But that's the reason that all of these diet books and things don't work. It's because one thing doesn't work for everyone. Everyone has a different family upbringing. Everyone has different beliefs and different strategies that they've used. And so they're at a different place. And so I guess the message here that I'm trying to instill is that if we can all just stay on that path of doing our best on a daily basis and learning new things on a daily basis, eventually we should get to a place where we've figured some of these things out and we're in a much better position than we were if we just stood there, tried to do it perfect, and if we didn't, did nothing.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Any negative circumstance that we currently have in our lives, whether it's, no matter what it is, if it's being large, was nurtured on a day-by-day basis over some period of time. You know, things just don't result just automatically that way. They occur over time. What we're talking about here is how do we begin this paradigm of reaching a neutral point of saying, you know what, let me turn this bus around in some way, or let me at least be looking forward and understanding what do I need to help. Two things, you know, support the choices that I want to make proactively to move towards what it is I want to move towards, and also understand the things that have resulted in getting me here. And I think what's interesting is many things, parts of the book are interesting, but specifically about understanding, I think the more understanding we can have about the factors in our environment and things that are outside of us that are influencing us, the more that we can interrupt those influences. If we could learn to, when we see that donut shop, to have that be a trigger of a feeling inside of us of empowerment versus one of, oh, I want a donut.
Or deprivation.
Or deprivation. Or, oh, I can't have that, right? If it was an empowering feeling, right? Or if we...
Yeah, I walked by a donut shop now. Granted, I've had a donut in the last several years, but it's not something I eat frequently. So I usually walk by a donut shop and go, they still have those things? People still go in there? But I don't look at it as, oh, a donut shop, I can't have one of those.
Right. So the difference is you had the donut didn't have you.
Right. Good point.
Right. Because there's so much of that, we get caught in these patterns of, you know, gotta have it, and it's just like autopilot, you know?
Of course, donuts aren't my problem. Chocolate is. But that's another story for another day. Fortunately, they don't have too many chocolate shops around.
Right.
No, we that's the other notion that I think is really important is, you know, we know a particular individual that really, really loves sugar. Well, this person actually is diabetic. And so it's not that the person so much loves sugar, but the person's addicted to sugar. And but it's not that we're saying that you can never, ever have those things again, because we all think sugar tastes good for the most part. It's a matter of saying, ah, okay, do I like sugar and I want a piece of sugar today, or am I being overrun and... manipulated by the sugar, in that we are addicted and we have to have it for biochemical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
That is when people tend to really get overweight and have the biggest challenge. There's nothing wrong with having a piece, a donut every so often, a bite of donut every so often, a bite of chocolate every so often. It's the eating large amounts of these things every day because of a biochemical response. When that happens, we have to look for it. What is the biochemical response that's happening? Search out somebody that can really help you. Go to see a nutritionist, see a doctor if you can find an open-minded doctor, but usually they just say, quote, lose weight and exercise, and that doesn't really help most people. But find somebody that really does understand these biochemical triggers, because there are naturopaths out there and doctors and nutritionists and all sorts of people out there that do understand these biochemical factors. Start to figure out, is it just that I'm liking that food and I'm trying to numb my pain, or, you know, is it that I like the food? Is it that I'm trying to numb my pain, my emotional pain that I'm having, or is it that I've got some biochemical imbalance? And if it really seems like you almost have this addiction to a food, go find somebody, because fat deficiencies will create significant fat cravings. So if you have the wrong kinds of fats, like trans fats and fried foods, your body isn't getting the fats it needs, so it will cause you to crave more fat. And then what do? You eat more fried foods, which increases the deficiency in the good fats that your body still isn't getting, and then you'll keep craving and craving. And it's not because you aren't eating enough fat, but you're not eating the right healthy fat. The same thing happens with sugar. If you get in a sugar imbalance and if you're eating healthy complex carbohydrates, you typically keep your blood sugar in balance, but when you start eating a lot of sugars, it gets out of balance, and then your body wants to actually crave more sugar, thinking that it needs to just deal with the emergency that it's in right now. And I could continue to go on and on. There's people that have gluten intolerances or wheat intolerance or dairy sensitivities, where these foods actually release endorphins or opiates in the brain and cause you to have really significant food cravings. So, you know, there's looking at balancing the gut, balancing the digestive capability, avoiding certain foods that are problematic, avoiding food ingredients like MSG. Those, you know, I can't just eat one potato chip. Well, that's because the potato chips have MSG, and they are sending a biochemical signal to your brain to eat more of them. So, I mean, these are just in a few minutes many of the factors that cause really significant food addictions or food cravings that makes it very difficult for people to lose weight. So, you know, start to, like he said in the book, accept your situation, get out of denial, accept that this is what's happening, and then look at what's really going on for you. Why is the eating happening? Is it out of your control? And then searching out ways to balance it, to bring it back in control.
Right, and there's so many different ways to identify those patterns, as you were saying, Julie, that are affecting the internal biochemistry, and begin to interrupt them, right? And
mm-hmm.
shift the course of events, both with regard to how we're treating our body and with regards to what's going on within our mind and the habituated patterns that have developed over time. That in this circumstance here, where, you know, food becomes a conduit to control and to self-love,
mm-hmm.
right? That becomes our outlet. It doesn't necessarily, for many, end up becoming a healthy one, right? So how can we begin to interrupt those patterns and shift both our patterns of thought, our triggered patterns of feeling as a result of certain stimuli? I mean, all these things that have been implanted over time, if they're not serving us, how we choose and realize we want to be now, we can shift them and modify them tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of finding the right resources, engaging in the right conversations, and it can be through outside assistance. It can even be through picking up somebody's book, reading it, and going, you know what? I get that now. I'm not the only one who's had this experience,
mm-hmm.
and I could begin to transcend some of my past patterning by stopping today and making a significant new realization that affects how I think about something, thus how I feel about it and how I'm going to have that play out for me the next time.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many different ways.
Absolutely. So in our last 2 minutes here or so, I just wanted to mention something really fast. He was talking about yoga, and I loved how he got so excited about it. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me of this book that hopefully we'll have this person on the show. There's a book called Born Yogis. I have to show you this book. It's all about babies doing yoga poses. Mm. And how yoga is these poses are a natural way the body moves. It's really amazing. So it was
pretty flexible in there.
Oh yeah. So it was just interesting to see him in a way get back to the joy that maybe we knew innately when we were babies, but it got lost over time. So hopefully we'll have them on. And this, you've been listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM, Reality Sandwich. You've been listening to Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. We have a practice here in San Francisco where we see clients and have radio shows and do all sorts of things. And I'm with
Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist and healthful living advocate. You can find us at healthfullivingsf.com. We'll be back next Thursday with another episode of Reality Sandwich. Coming up next, Connecting the Dots. Thanks for tuning in.